The following content is sponsored by Atlantis Sports Clubs and does not reflect the views of WATD Radio. It's Friends with Benefits on 95.9 WATD, exploring relationships, social issues, sports, and life stories. Be a part of the show at 781-837-4900. This is Brian Stratton's Friends with Benefits with your hosts, Paul Kearney, Gabe Sirota, Joe Coletti, and Bob Anderson.
Thank you for joining again another Thursday night on Friends with Benefits with our next guest is David Layden, here to talk with us. David is from Weill Cornell Medical College. David is the Administrative Director of Telemedicine Services and Director of Planning and Development at Weill Cornell Medicine, New York Presbyterian's Department of Emergency Medicine. He oversees all administrative aspects of the department's telemedicine service lines and the department's telemedicine training and education effort through the Center for Virtual Care. David also works closely with departmental leadership to support strategical departmental priorities. David has extensive experience in academic medical center and nonprofit management throughout his career. David has been involved in the development of new programs and strategic initiatives. David has expertise in finance, operations, graduate program education, sponsored research administration, and strategic planning. David received his master's degree from Columbia University in public administration and is also a certified research administrator and certified telehealth facilitator. Hello, David.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for the kind introduction. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Telehealth is an exciting topic in healthcare today. So also on the show with us tonight is our show sponsor and managing partner of Blue Cirrus Consulting, Michelle Hager. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Joe. Hi, David. So glad to have you on the show tonight. It's going to be really exciting to hear about your experience and what Weill Cornell is doing to respond to this really difficult time.
Thank you, Michelle. It's a pleasure joining both you and Joe this evening.
And just recently, I enjoyed listening to your presentation on virtual care at the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic Virtual Telehealth Conference titled Launching into Telehealth. I thought Dr. Peter Greenwald's presentation was very timely for telehealth as we start hearing healthcare organizations in hospitals providing care remotely today. What can a student expect to learn from your course at Weill Cornell?
Well, it was great to have an opportunity to participate in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic Virtual Telehealth Conference with so many of our colleagues who are very active in this space. Our telemedicine education and training programs at Cornell really offer extensive training in the basics of telemedicine, website manner, how can a physician or another clinician actually give a remote patient examination, and we also cover topics such as to provider telemedicine consulting.
So expand on this idea of website manner, because we've heard this before. We had Dr. from Harvard, who's now Dr. Joe Cavita, who's now the president of ATA. So tell our listeners a little bit more about website manner.
So I think clinicians are taught so much in school about bedside manner and how to actually, you know, engage with the patient. I think it's a little bit difficult when you're, you know, when you're interacting remotely with the patient, but also need to be mindful of, you know, what type of soft skills, as we like to call them, you know, should the provider be offering to the patient. So first of all, I think just putting them at ease, provider being comfortable is certainly a key in putting the patient at ease and ensuring their comfort as well. I think, you know, letting the patient know that you're going to actually be doing a remote examination, and the fact that you can actually do an examination remotely, which some people probably, that's a new concept for them, or was a new concept before COVID, letting the patient know that you're going to be helping them, that they may need to help you with vitals, such as taking their temperature or pulse or other things. So kind of setting up expectations for the visit and letting the patient know that even though you might be, you know, located hundreds of miles away, you're there to provide them with the best possible patient care. And of course, our ultimate focus is on, you know, on patient outcomes and improving patient outcomes. So I think just setting those expectations for the visit and really having a chance to connect with the patient and ensuring comfort for both patient and provider. Different than, of course, you know, being in person and having a chance to interact with someone, you know, face-to-face. It's always a little bit more challenging, I think, you know, over video.
Absolutely.
Yes. I was on your website earlier this week, and I was reading about the Weill Cornell Emergency Medicine Center for Virtual Care, known as CVC. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yep, Joe, certainly. The Center for Virtual Care was established in 2019 before COVID, and it really had a mission to improve the delivery of virtual healthcare services across the healthcare system. So as I was just mentioning, we provide formal telemedicine training, and we do it for clinicians at all levels. So that could be attending physicians, residents, fellows, advanced practice providers, such as PAs and NPs, nurses, care managers, et cetera, anyone who's kind of involved in telemedicine across the healthcare spectrum. And we also offer training to folks in various clinical specialties. So from psychiatry to dermatology to urology to OBGYN, we do it all. And really, although it's an emergency department-led initiative, it's really encompassing of instructors from different clinical areas, not just our own emergency medicine folks, but folks who have extensive experience and are really kind of on the front line of telemedicine and virtual care. And just offering, you know, training, as we just discussed, on a website manner, ensuring that providers are up to speed in terms of what technical requirements are needed to actually do a telemedicine visit, focusing on some of the medical legal issues that and regulatory issues that are out there, which touches licensing, which a lot of providers are not aware of before they take our training program. And it really seeks to kind of, again, provide a kind of a formal training program for folks who are doing telemedicine. We, and our providers at Weill Cornell, we ensure that they all go through our training program before they actually do a virtual care visit. Upon completion of the course, folks get a certificate, and it's also open for students, medical students, physician assistant students, et cetera. So really a comprehensive training program led by kind of the folks that are on the front line of telemedicine and virtual care.
Mm-hmm. So really incorporating that telehealth visit into the care delivery model. So it's a seamless care from face-to-face to virtual, regardless of where you are in the care continuum for various patients.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we face in emergency medicine, of course, is we oftentimes don't have an established relationship with the patient. So one of the things we also want to focus on is it's not, you know, you're seeing your primary care doctor or dermatologist via telemedicine. It's really ensuring that if a patient, you know, is hundreds of miles away and connecting with you via a video visit, that they're really, you know, comfortable, you know, trust the clinician that's providing them care and know that they're getting the best possible care that's available to them. So, I think having that unified standard of care is very important. I think folks before COVID maybe didn't think about it. That's certainly changed as we've seen the exponential increase in the use of telemedicine.
David, what would you say is the most essential elements for delivering a telehealth visit?
So I think it's really, again, making sure that the provider is putting the best image forward to gain patient trust and to really establish that therapeutic relationship. So I think that's, you know, absolutely essential. And it's not the same thing as going into, you know, if you walk into a doctor's office, you or a hospital, you see, you know, branding, signage all over saying, you know, for instance, you're going to Weill Cornell, telemedicine visit. If you just have a visit with a provider who's not wearing a white coat, not wearing an ID, doesn't have a proper backdrop, and they're just wearing, you know, a t-shirt with no ID, you know, it looks like they have, you know, their family within listening distance, probably not going to be a great experience for the patient. So kind of thinking about all mm-hmm. those things that go into it, there's a lot of, you know, framing, camera angles. I think we've all done probably so many Zoom meetings over the past several months, are probably all more aware than we used to be of some of these things. But I think that's really essential. And also connecting with the patients, letting them know that it's, you know, it's not the same as an in-person visit, but it can be pretty similar. And then they, you know, you really can provide an exam for a patient, you know, remotely, especially when we're talking about some lower acuity issues, a service such as virtual urgent care. So I think that's the most important. And I think also just being mindful, of course, some of the medical legal issues we spoke about before and ensuring that, you know, you're well aware of all those and, you know, mitigating risk to the provider as well as the institution is certainly, you know, certainly something that's important.
So David, let me ask you a question about virtual medical exam that you've referenced a couple of times in this conversation. Some of our listeners may not know what that looks like. Certainly, if you go into your doctor's office in person, you know, the doctor may feel on your neck, check your lymph nodes, you know, take your blood pressure, things like that. And obviously in a virtual environment, despite what the Jetsons may have demonstrated, that's not really going to happen. And so talk to our listeners a little bit about what that virtual physical exam looks like, because the doctor needs to not only hear from the person, but also listen to the body, right? That's part of medical training.
Absolutely. So I think the patient critical role in that. So we certainly take advantage of everything the patient has at home to help assist with the virtual exam. But if the patient has a thermometer, we'll ask them to use it to take their temperature. Blood pressure cuff, they can certainly be really beneficial in terms of taking a patient's blood pressure, a patient taking their pulse. So really having the patient kind of help with the visit, and also just being, you know, through experience with telemedicine, being able to kind of utilize the camera, the actual angles, and being, if someone has a rash, how can I get the best view via a remote encounter to actually kind of see that rash? So if a patient has swollen lymph nodes, you know, how am I able to get a good view of that? Obviously, it's going to be different than, you know, than an in-person encounter. So really kind of having comfort and being able to ask patients the right questions, I think, is certainly critical. And why, you know, I've referenced it a few times, and why we focus on it so much is that I think, again, before COVID, some folks would probably say, you know, you can't do an exam remotely. But I think we've all probably have been through now a telemedicine and visit and seen that that's, you know, that you certainly, you know, certainly can, and you certainly can provide, you know, care. And I think something else for our clinicians to think about is really this issue of medical decision making. So, right, it might be different if a patient has an emergency, for instance, you know, via telemedicine visit versus in person. So what the provider does is going to be different. So just thinking about, you know, how telemedicine affects medical decision making, you know, and vice versa, I think is some of the topics that we go through as we, you know, kind of really try to focus on the soup to nuts, A to Z, if you will, component of telemedicine education before providers are actually seeing their own patients.
Absolutely.
Going back to those CVC telemedicine training modules, what can a student expect? What were the three steps that helped explain the CVC telemedicine training modules?
So we start out with an online course. So it's a self-paced course that folks can take, kind of a flipped classroom. So they'll basically go online, complete about an hour course that focuses on really some of these basics of telemedicine that we've been speaking about before they actually do an encounter with us. Then we do an experiential learning component. So basically it's a simulation. And so we'll have an actor play a standardized patient, and we'll actually do case encounters with clinicians. So psychiatrists, for instance, if they were going through training, they might have an actor playing a patient with depression and kind of go through, and we'll actually record that session. So go through a whole simulated encounter and then take a look at that. No one likes to see themselves on tape for a good reason sometimes, but we can certainly see, you know, how could the exam have gone better? What are some of the things that worked? What are some of the things that didn't work? So really providing a detailed debrief about what went well, what could have been done better. And then, you know, after the folks have gone through our training program, we always like to see them on their own platform. So we also offer a refresher to folks, and really kind of, we can offer a remote kind of, you know, one-to-one or small group shadowing session to see how they're doing actually with their own patients on their own EMR and seeing patients via telemedicine. So that focuses from the outside at kind of what is telemedicine, what are the basics of telemedicine, right through to seeing your own patients, you know, how are their visits going, and what could be improved upon, and again, what is working well.
It's fantastic.
So what would you say are some of the top telehealth programs Weill Cornell Medical College is preparing to offer in 2020 and 2021?
So we actually started our telemedicine services in the emergency department in 2016. So we were an early adopter of telehealth, and we have several different active service lines that are in place right now. In the coming year, I think things, we'll certainly see how things go, but one of our priorities is to expand our community teleparamedicine program, which is really an innovative program where emergency medical personnel, EMS workers, actually go out into a patient's home and connect with a telemedicine emergency medicine doctor to do a patient examination. So a patient might have, you know, severe case of congestive heart failure. And we certainly don't want that patient to keep coming into the emergency department or have to go out and see their cardiologist repeatedly. So we can actually bring the hospital, you know, to the patient. We can do medical reconciliation. We can check patients' vitals. We can just get a sense of how they're doing since their last visit and really do a lot of that monitoring from home. So we're expanding that service to 7 days a week. And we're also focusing on different uses of telemedicine, innovative uses. And we're really focused on, you know, this kind of transformation of healthcare delivery through telemedicine. So again, this whole concept of the hospital at home or the virtual hospital, remote patient monitoring is something that we're certainly interested in and looking at areas that we could expand that. If we have patients that are coming into the emergency department with, you know, pneumonia, let's say, we can follow up on them without them having to come in for a repeat. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that a number of, as technology, I think, continues to expand, I think we'll be able to do more monitoring of patients from home and have more interaction with patients and providers. So those are some of the areas that we're focused on in the upcoming year. And we'll see, of course, everything is kind of a bit to be determined with COVID, but those are some of the kind of the areas we're thinking about now.
So this emergency paramedic module is really, really interesting. It's something that I'm hearing is happening in several places across the country. Certainly Weill Cornell is, you know, spearheading that, part on the forefront of that, given your experience in the telemedicine space. How are you determining where you're going to be targeting your paramedic services? Obviously, you don't have unlimited amount of ambulances and paramedics and EMTs, et cetera, to put out there, particularly in this age of COVID. Are you looking at zip codes or usage of the hospital, or are you really looking at it as a patient follow, like a hospital at a home that you mentioned?
So this program has been, at least up until now, has really been focused on patient referrals. So it really focuses on patients with high acuity problems such as congestive heart failure, COPD, diabetes. So we will get referrals from providers who are kind of partnering with our group. And then we'll follow up on the patients and we'll determine, you know, does the patient need a visit once a week, twice a week. But we've certainly been thinking about expanding it, thinking about patients who are discharged from our emergency department that may also need follow-up. And I think, you know, it also gets into some of the issues about healthcare, access to healthcare, disparities in healthcare. So certainly, I think as folks think about the virtual hospital, we need to be mindful that we're offering those type of services to everyone, including those who are maybe uninsured or underinsured, so that we have as much access as possible to healthcare. So I think it's definitely the way of the future. Just need to be careful that we're in the folks who might need care the most.
Absolutely. Good point.
Yeah, very good. So who's better than you to ask? How is Cornell Medical College planning to return students through this pandemic? What's your plan?
So in terms of our telemedicine training and education programs, they've all gone virtual at this time. And I think they'll be virtual in the foreseeable future. And in addition to the kind of some of the training I mentioned earlier, where we've expanded our services, so because we're, you know, in this era of COVID now. So for instance, the simulation that we do is all held via Zoom. The debriefs we do are all held via Zoom. We've also done a lot more small group and individual shadow sessions. So we'll have providers shadow our emergency department physicians doing telehealth visits. And then again, we'll flip the script to how they're doing in their visits. We've also done a lot of, you know, live webinars and taped webinars just to make, you know, training a bit more accessible. And we're building out our training, the online training module, we're building it out to be more robust. So I think it'll be virtual for the foreseeable future. We have a beautiful training location in Midtown Manhattan. I don't think most people are traveling at the moment. So we really have, you know, remained agile and been, you know, we're pretty adept at modifying our training approach and trying to make sure we're offering the same services to our learners that we were when the training was in person.
Okay, that's great. So we've sort of been avoiding that COVID question and talking about telehealth in this time. What would you say your response is to COVID and plans for a second wave?
Right. So as you know, in the spring, New York City was certainly, New York State and New York City in particular, were certainly the epicenter of the COVID pandemic in the U.S. So we very quickly ramped up our telemedicine efforts. We were fortunate, as I mentioned, our programs started in 2016. So we had an existing infrastructure in place, which we were able to leverage. Our virtual urgent care program, which runs 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, that experienced a 20-fold increase in patient volume. We very quickly had to redeploy physicians from outside of emergency medicine to help support the patient volume that we were seeing. So we had folks from psychiatry, from physical rehab to OBGYN to urology, to ophthalmology, really across the board, helping to support our efforts. And all of these folks went through a very kind of comprehensive training program in a short period of time with us before they saw patients on their own. And they all went through this kind of assigned a mentor. They all went through this mentor training. We had a robust quality assurance program in place to ensure that patients, you know, patient safety and patient quality was of the utmost importance for this program. Really kind of put people to work. And I think one of the interesting anecdotes about the experience was that we set up a WhatsApp chat group. So these folks who didn't know each other to help provide support. You had a, you know, an ophthalmologist who certainly hadn't dealt with emergency medicine level issues in, you know, in so many years, to reach out in real time to one of our emergency medicine physicians and, you know, and get their guidance. And vice versa, if someone happened to come in with a problem with their eye, they could reach out to the ophthalmologist. So certainly something that was unique that we didn't necessarily see. We really were able to form a great partnership, and our psychiatrists who joined were absolutely phenomenal. We had a number of patients calling in with COVID who had anxiety and depression, and we were able to connect them right away with one of our psychiatrists. So it really kind of added to the patient care we were offering. And it was able to keep folks who had COVID-like illness, but maybe not as severe, or who had other low acuity health problems out of the emergency department. We weren't overwhelmed. Obviously, we're facing, you know, a significant number of patients who had, you know, more severe symptoms of COVID that were in our hospital and intubated that we were working with. So it certainly helped, you know, helped in that capacity. In the emergency department, we expanded our use of telemedicine carts. So we had a number of patients who had COVID or suspected COVID who were in isolation rooms. So we put these carts in their room. So it really allowed, although the provider would have to go in, they, instead of having to go in five times in a day, they can go in less times. They connect to the patient, you know, via this. Mm-hmm. The same thing with the nurse that would have gone in there. Our social workers were not on site during some of the COVID pandemic, so they were able to connect remotely. So it really made a big difference for those patients. And then just, you know, again, because of, you know, space restrictions, we had to discharge patients out of mild respiratory distress who otherwise would have been admitted. So we discharged these patients and we followed up on them via virtual care, follow-up visit by either our physicians or nurse practitioners for up to 7 days. So created kind of the safety net for folks who were discharged. And the same for our virtual urgent care program. We followed up on patients that we thought needed to be looked at further. So we really kind of were using telemedicine in every way possible. That was really, we were really fortunate to have the infrastructure in place that we did so that we were able to leverage it so significantly. But in terms of the second wave, we're monitoring our numbers very closely. And we have a kind of an algorithm in place about when we need to increase coverage based upon the number of patients that we're seeing. We have now have an increased technology, these carts I was referencing, we have more than we had, you know, pre-COVID. We also have kind of this kind of unprecedented physician redeployment, and not just physician, but also advanced practice provider redeployment that we did. We now have experience doing it, and we have folks who have been trained in our services. So we have a kind of a team, an army of folks that we can, you know, rely upon. It's tremendous support from our academic and hospital leadership for our telemedicine programs, and it made all of the difference when it came to the care we were able to provide during COVID. And I think it remains to be seen what will happen this fall, but we're certainly ready if a second wave hits New York.
It's, you've been able to just expand that program, you know, so quickly, been able to jump it up and really create an interdisciplinary program, forced it, right? So now we have to see the various specialties and various types of clinical practices working together that I think patients typically think are happening behind the scenes, but doesn't always happen the way we think as a patient, because there are sort of barriers in the way, just in the way that we practice. So you're able to take that and really be able to break those barriers down via telehealth and start that interdisciplinary approach. And I know from our conversations and certainly from a news broadcast, et cetera, that we know that while Cornell is some of the folks that graduated some of these students a little bit early to be able to respond to this, you know, crises, how did those students adapt, and how did your program have to adapt to be able to give them the support they needed virtually in some cases to be able to care for patients?
Our graduation was early for some students. We had to had a vary for all of our folks who were kind of joining without the amount of time they would have normally had in terms of getting started. We created this rapid onboarding process, and it really helped to partner people up with a mentor, someone who could help them and could help them with their first shift, their first two shifts. So kind of creating this co-management of patients, robust onboarding, and really this quality assurance program so that if ever an issue arose, we were addressing it certainly in real time. We were really able to utilize our more experienced clinicians to help out with those who were new or new to telemedicine. But we certainly, it was an all hands on deck approach. Certainly we had some folks across the country who were volunteering to help us in New York. So I think that was something good could come out of a bad situation. That was certainly, yeah, that we had tremendous community support. We had donations, food, and other things on a daily basis. Folks were sending us masks. I mean, it was really kind of heartfelt to see what was happening in the community. And certainly every day at 7 p.m. for quite a long time, folks were kind of banging pans, having like bells and whistles to kind of support healthcare workers. I think that made all of the difference. And the medical students who were weren't in their fourth year, were still in the program, we created some electives for them so that they could actually take courses. And we set up some shadowing opportunities for them so that they could actually shadow some of our telemedicine visits, you know, virtually. But really, it just requires, I think, agility was the number one thing. Collaboration is certainly was key. And also just, you know, focusing on wellness, because it was certainly, you know, an older, you know, clinician wellness while they're really on the front line with this pandemic.
Amazing.
Tell us what's coming, what's upcoming events this year for Weill Cornell.
So we have a virtual healthcare conference coming up in October. It's our third conference. It's our first time doing it virtually, of course, everything virtual now. And the conference will focus on the use of telemedicine in the COVID era. It'll feature some top name speakers throughout the field of telemedicine, healthcare innovation. And we're also doing a research component for the first time. So we'll also be accepting abstracts for submission. So it's a day and a half conference. It's coming up October 8th and 9th. And we really think, you know, in this COVID era, we really see telemedicine, you know, as is here to stay, certainly with some of the regulatory and billing waivers that are in place right now. The fact that telemedicine allows you to, you know, conserve valuable resources such as PPE, it certainly helps to, you know, mitigate the risk to patients and providers, and certainly reduces community spread, keeping folks at home. And I think, I'm sure as you all have experience as well in talking to folks in your network, I think telemedicine is certainly, patients have come to expect telemedicine. If I have a minor rash, do I need to go in person to see my dermatologist, or can I do a telemedicine consult? So patient expectations now for this, I think the playing field has certainly changed from where it was before. So we'll be examining some of those questions throughout the conference. So we're excited to host that and excited to do it, you know, to do it virtually and see how that goes for the first time. But again, just need to stay active and be able to adapt quickly.
Flexible is the term for 2020.
Yes, flexibility. We've all learned that. I think we've all learned that over the last several months in this note, and we'll continue to learn that.
Exactly.
Well, we're talking to David Layden from Weill Cornell Medical College. It was great talking to you. I appreciate your time today. We always want to provide our listeners with helpful information on this show, and I appreciate your answers to explain how to train students to start implementing telehealth strategies into their care plans. You can find more information about Weill Cornell at weill.cornell.edu. Check out their website. There's a lot of great information, updates. It's just a great website to look into. And also many thanks to our show sponsor, Michelle Hager and Blue Seraph Consulting, for the opportunity to share information about telehealth and how we can help hospital and health organizations around the country planning and implementing their telehealth programs. Thanks again, David. Thanks, Michelle. And enjoy the rest of the night, and we'll have you back soon. Thank you so much.
Sounds great. Thank you, Joe and Michelle. It was my pleasure. Enjoy your evening.
Thank you, David.
Experience the Atlantis Sports Club difference. Atlantis Sports Club and Spas are located throughout Massachusetts, including locations in Dedham, Danvers, and Hyannis. Featuring state-of-the-art cardiovascular and strength training equipment, plus indoor and outdoor pools and full-service spas, Atlantis offers something for everyone. How about Zumba, spinning, and strength training classes, swim lessons for the kids, or a luxurious spa treatment? Your Atlantis membership allows access to all locations. Atlantis in Dedham is located at 25 Allied Drive at the Hilton Hotel in Dedham. When you're on the North Shore, check out the Danvers location located at Ferncroft, next to the Coco Key Water Park at the Hilton. Take a mini vacation at Atlantis Sports Club and Spa in Hyannis. Play golf, then relax by the resort-style pool. Mention this ad and receive 20% off any spa treatment. Experience the Atlantis difference today. Visit AtlantisSportsClubs.com and book your tour today.
Hey Joe, please tell me about your new company, Blue Seraph Consulting. This is a new way I can actually stay home and receive quality health care by using today's technology?
Yeah, thanks. It's called telehealth. It's sweeping the nation. It's great. It saves lives, it saves time, and it saves money.
Great, but why isn't my hospital offering it to me?
Well, hospitals are being flooded with new software vendors and technology, making it difficult for hospitals to make clear decisions and choose which telehealth program is right for them. In fact, Blue Seraph Consulting can bring telehealth to local hospitals here in New England. We have a track record of providing skilled advisors, clinicians, and project leaders to support your hospital and help them accomplish a quality telehealth program.
Hey Joe, how do I find out more information?
Thanks, Paul. You can go online at blue-seraph.com. That's blue as in the color, dash Cirrus, C-I-R-R-U-S, as in the cloud, .com, and find all of our company information online. Blue Seraph saves lives, saves time, and saves money.
This is Bob Anderson, owner of Upper Entertainment, promoter and agent for some of New England's best musical and comedy talent. If you want the very best acts at your clubs, weddings, parties, or private events, look no further than Upper Entertainment. You can reach us at 781-249-0113. Call Upper Entertainment at 781-249-0113.
WATD 95.9 FM, Friends with Benefits. Our next guest on the phone, who was on our show last December, is Dr. Tina Gustin, who is currently an assistant professor at Old Dominion University School of Nursing, where she teaches in the Doctor of Nursing Practice program. Dr. Gustin was most recently appointed as the director of the School Center for Telehealth, Innovation, Education, and Research, known as CTER. The center will serve as a telehealth learning hub and research center, not only for the state, but also the East Coast region of the U.S. Hi, Dr. Gustin.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me again. It's really a pleasure to join you tonight and to talk about a subject that I'm very passionate about.
Thank you. Telehealth is an exciting topic on this show, especially today, as our country is relying on telehealth to keep providers and patients safe. Also, please say hello to our show sponsor from Blue Seraph Consulting, our managing partner, Michelle Hager.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Tina. Good to talk to you again. It's great to have you on the show again tonight. You were great last time. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say tonight.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, it was great having you. Back in December 2009, we discussed some of the unique etiquette skills necessary for a successful telehealth encounter pre-COVID. And now telehealth is mostly recognized by our country as a modality to saving lives by keeping patients and providers at a safe distance. So, Dr. Gustin, what are you doing today to keep them safe, but also being professional and offering the best care during this pandemic?
Oh, Joe, that's a fabulous question, and it's a loaded one, isn't it? Back in December of 2019, we were really in a space where we were still trying to convince providers that telehealth was a way to go. And as we all know, when the COVID pandemic hit, both providers and patients totally pivoted to telehealth. I like to say we were drinking telehealth through a fire hose, and everyone needed to start utilizing telehealth, and most were not prepared for it. I can tell you something that happened locally with us at CPIER. We were approached by our medical school that's local and just said, we don't know how to prepare our students to go into clinical practice. All of their clinical sites were shut down. The students didn't know how to utilize telehealth. Providers were having to use telehealth. Faculty didn't know how to prepare the students for telehealth. So we quickly developed a program for the medical school to teach both faculty and students how to safely and successfully use telehealth, and also, importantly, how to be precepted using telehealth technologies.
Wow.
So this is just something that organizations on all ends are having to adjust to. I mean, so if you think about it, the students were not allowed to go into a clinical setting. So the students were at their home. Patients were at their home, and providers were either at their home or in the hospital or clinic setting. And they needed to learn the nuances of how do you communicate with a student virtually. You know, when do you bring them into the visit? When do you put them in a waiting room? When do you put the patient into a waiting room? And how do you conduct that mentoring that everyone is so comfortable with standing at the bedside or in a clinic? And how are we now going to do that virtually? And frankly, we've pivoted throughout the United States with that type of mentoring. And it is and probably will be as we enter this new academic year, the only way that we're able to get clinical hours for a cadre of professional students, medical students, nursing students, social work students. We're not going to have graduates if we can't get their clinical hours in, and telehealth has been the modality for that.
That's a really good point.
That is a good point. Mm-hmm. I read on the website at the 2019 State of the College Address, President John Broderick officially announced Old Dominion University Center for Telehealth Innovation, Education, and Research, CTIER. I know you and Carolyn Rutledge were instrumental in putting this program together. Please tell us a little bit about the ODU CTIER program. What can students expect to learn from this course?
Okay, well, CTIER, as its name applies with the arm, we have telehealth, we have innovation, we have education, and we have research. Prior to the COVID pandemic, we brought our students onto campus, and we had virtual learning, we had in-person learning, and we have quite a bit of telehealth equipment available to the students to touch and to interface with. We ran hackathons and whatnot. But with the COVID, with regards to education, we've developed a certificate program to prepare interprofessional students to deliver telehealth. And not only deliver telehealth, but in this certificate, it's how do you plan for it? How do you prepare for it? How do you present it? And most importantly, how do you then evaluate your telehealth program? So we're preparing our students to not just do telehealth, but to understand all aspects of a telehealth program. With innovation, we're working with entrepreneurs and other departments within the university. Some of the things we're doing through the CTIER is a robot development, where we are designing our own robot that will be piloted at the Children's Hospital that will engage children that are isolated. So that the children can operate the robot and go into other areas of the hospital for patient engagement. We're also, through the center, designing a training platform for telehealth etiquette, where the students will be able to conduct a visit with an avatar on the other side that is giving that student real-time feedback on their etiquette skills with regard to examples of eye gaze and how the room was set up and did they get a consent at the start of the visit. So this avatar is going to give consistent feedback that does not always occur with a standardized patient. So those are just some examples of what we're doing with innovation. An example of what we're doing at the Center for Research is we have developed in conjunction or working in conjunction with another provider, a dietitian at another university, instrument that has been designed to evaluate students' performance on telehealth etiquette. So through the center, we've been running our students through the certificate program utilizing this instrument, and we're now evaluating it, and we'll be publishing the data. So we're collaborating with another university to research their instrument. So those are just some examples of what we're doing at CTIER.
Excellent.
So, Tina, I think that's great that you're teaching the etiquette piece, because how many of us have been on those calls with people where all you see are their eyes, or all you see are the ceiling or whatever. So that's fantastic that you're doing that. It's a real skill to learn how to present clinically via telehealth. But I wanted to ask you one question about the robot. I think this is such a cool technology that you all have at the CTIER. And I think our listeners would be interested about that. How did that get developed? And exactly, these are patients that are isolated and can't leave their room. And so the robot allows them to extend themselves like an avatar around the hospital.
You're absolutely right. This is really, I call this my passion project. I was visiting, I have a dog and I do pet therapy at the hospital, and was visiting a family that was isolated, a child that was isolated. And then kind of chatting about what I do and what they did, I was telling them about some of what we were doing at the school. And he said, "Oh guys, you have it all wrong. These kids need the robot for engagement." And he was exactly right. So children in particular need socialization. They need to be around other kids. And many children throughout the United States that are in hospitals are critically ill or chronically ill and are in their rooms for weeks at a time. You know, cystic fibrosis children, cancer children. And so this robot is being designed so the child can operate it with an iPad or an iPhone, and can move the robot out throughout the unit into other patients' rooms. There's a camera on the robot, so the child can see who that robot is interfacing with on their handheld device. And there's a microphone, and they can talk back and forth to each other. So I've had people ask me, well, why not just give the other patient an iPad and they communicate with each other through the iPad? Well, then you're taking away that autonomy from the child to be able to take that robot where they want that robot to go. So it came out of a family's idea. And in developing it, we've had focus groups with both nurses. We've also taken the robot specs to an art program for gifted children in the area, and they've drawn out what they think the robot should look like. So we're designing it in a way that is very kid-friendly, but also fits the needs of a hospital, because we've had input from hospital employees that would be working with this robot.
That's fantastic. It's such a great program, and it'll advance, right, over time. That's the great thing about it. It's sort of, this is where it is today, but what will it look like in 10 years? You know, will there be an avatar for those children that are chronically ill or fragile in the hospital? So during COVID and this public health emergency, hospitals have certainly curtailed elective procedures. Access to in-person clinical care is limited, and we've seen a dramatic increase in telehealth across the nation. Most people now know that term, telehealth. And of course, since the public health emergency, almost 1.7 million visits have occurred since the last week of April. So we know even in May and in June and July, we still have another 3 months that we've added onto that. So everybody is really doing telehealth like crazy. What challenges does your health system face with such a dramatic surge in telehealth visits? And with it being a children's hospital, you might be right at the beginning of that wave. So I'm interested to know kind of what you're doing to prepare well.
That is a great question, and we're not unique in the problem. We went, just some early numbers, we went from 5 providers in behavioral health doing telehealth, 500 providers, and we went from 600 visits in a year to a little over 1,200 in the first 2 weeks of COVID. So we've really had to shift, and as you can imagine, preparing all of those providers, one of our problems, a good problem, I would guess you would say, is what's our platform? We had not purchased a platform to date, a specific telehealth platform. We still haven't. We're using some of the Zoom technology, and we're shopping for platforms. And I'm kind of proud of our institution for doing that because, as you know, Michelle, when this started, facilities started buying platforms quickly. And I think that there's quite a bit of buyer's remorse right now with regards to did we get the right thing? Was it right for our patient population? So we've had to prepare providers. We've had to pivot, kind of figuring out what are we going to use? What's the bandwidth? And then think about this. When COVID happened, children were not coming in for their primary care visits, for their yearly visits. Parents were afraid to bring their kids in. So they shifted to these yearly visits virtually, but then with these visits, the children are usually vaccinated. So what we found was a drastic decrease in vaccinations, and our families were afraid to bring the kids in for vaccinations. So we had to then kind of pivot again and figure out how can we do a virtual visit, bill for the virtual visit, but then have the child do drive-by vaccinations. I mean, we really had to get creative with maintaining the overall health of this pediatric population during this pandemic. Most of the practices shifted to probably 90% virtual encounters. We've gone back to about 40 now and think that we'll probably stay at about 40%.
Yeah.
You know, other than the vaccination telehealth visits that you had to overcome, what were some of the more common telehealth for patients and doctors in keeping everybody safe?
Well, really all of our visits shifted to telehealth. And in the pediatric setting, when this pandemic started, the children really weren't being affected. So we weren't having to do the COVID screening that the adult medicine folks were doing. I mean, most of adult medicine, they did all the COVID screening tests virtually. You know, we really weren't having to do that because the kids, the kids weren't developing COVID early on. I can tell you one of the projects that we had already started pre-COVID was a remote patient monitoring program with our pain and palliative care patients. And interesting, those families are loving the RPM. It's keeping their very, very critically ill child out of the hospital. And it was hard prior to COVID to get a program to want to pilot this. The RPM project and the pain and palliative care program, I think, happened because it was a young clinician. She was new and really very excited. Fast forward after the start of this project in April, and I've got probably 4 other practices now with chronically ill kids that want to do the same type of delivery for their children. You know, you've got the bad asthmatics that aren't able to come into the hospital to have their spirometry testing, because when you do a spirometry testing or peak flow testing and whatnot for their asthma, you're blowing. And when you blow, you know, the virus. So they want to be able to do this at home and not have the kids come in. I mean, so there are other populations that really could benefit from this type of technology. The problem is it's expensive and we don't have full reimbursement for it.
Yeah, that is the key, isn't it? The reimbursement element. And we know that there have been several executive orders that have come out in the last few weeks related to telehealth. One in particular is the president's executive order on improving rural health and telehealth access. And I know some of the senators from your state in Virginia, my state in South Carolina, and the senators in Massachusetts as well, are also looking at how to expand broadband access, which is shockingly lacking in many parts of the country. And that's just a cost basis. Companies that provide internet services don't going to go into rural areas because there aren't as customers to sell to. So they don't extend the fiber, they don't extend the broadband into those areas. And then those same people need to access telehealth via those same broadband lines. So we know that, you know, that executive order was looking at reviewing all of the telehealth waivers implemented during the public health emergency and extending that appropriate. We know Seema Verna, as well as Alex Azar, spent some time, you know, going through the rules and made some recommendations recently. Wanted to look at permanently enshrining some of these telehealth rules into the codification of those reimbursement rules, essentially. And they're eager to participate and have the community's perspective on what types of services are appropriate. We are in the public comment period for that review. But what are your thoughts on rural health, telehealth access, this broadband issue that we have across the country?
What do you say? I mean, other than it's a loaded question. I mean, telehealth in the last couple months has probably gone forward by 5 years. In 5 months, we've done 5 years of telehealth advancement. And we have clearly shown that it improves the health of the nation, that our patients are satisfied and happy with it. I don't think we're ever going back. But what it's also shown is the inequity. And the inequity is with the rural resident that does not have access to this technology and this type of care. And it's unacceptable.
Absolutely true. There's a real demonstration of the digital divide now, right? When that inequity that you just spoke about, it's really good.
They're in danger. Their lives are in danger. So this is a big time for tele.
You're absolutely right. And going back to the remote patient monitoring project, you know, we have 20 devices, it's research. And we had several families that were not able to participate because they lived in a rural area. They needed it more than the people that were 10 minutes from the hospital. And they couldn't participate because they didn't have the connectivity. Again, I mean, it's unacceptable.
And I also read this Resideo Life that you offer your students at Old Dominion, part of your curriculum. Can you tell us a little bit about this and how they can provide care and measure that care?
Certainly. So Resideo Life Care Solutions is one of the remote patient monitoring devices that's available to providers in the United States. We've partnered with them through CTier now for several years. So we've got the tablet, the Livestream tablet with the peripherals. So the students are able to simulate that type of care in their training sessions so that they're aware, they learn how to be the provider that is with the patient in the home, and they also learn how to be the provider that is managing the dashboard and the patient distantly. Resideo kindly partnered with me through the hospital, and they were the ones that donated the 20 devices for us to do the research with the pediatric patients, because that is not a technology that has typically been in the pediatric space. And through CTier, we've also been able to take that research project and incorporate three of our doctorate students into that program to evaluate the satisfaction with the families, to look at, through this Resideo device, are we decreasing this appointment? Are we decreasing travel time? Being able to monitor kids through this platform with a scale and a blood pressure monitor and an oximeter, and parents doing asynchronous communication to the provider. How are we enhancing the health of the child? So Resideo has been a really fabulous partner with CTier now for several years. And I think it's an example of how vendors can work with training centers. And we've had, oh my golly, I think to date, 800 students a year able to manipulate and play with and learn how to do this type of monitoring on chronically ill patients.
So important.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is not enough to just talk about telehealth. You need to do didactic. You need to touch it. You need to play with it. And then you need to then take it into the clinical setting, like these students have taken it into a clinical setting and researching it.
Absolutely. It needs that rigor, right? It needs the testing of it. It needs the research of it. We need some data, and we need the best practices, to understand how telehealth can best be used. And we just saw an article just published that the American Telemedicine Association, AmeriCare, among others, have just started to create a group. They will start to formulate some of these standards, which is important because we have everybody in this industry. Now that we're starting these standards, or we see some of these organizations popping up to start standards, what do you think about this announcement?
I applaud them. It's very exciting. And I also feel that nursing clearly needs to be at this table with regards to standards and competencies, but nursing is missing. And we just had a group of 24 nurse leaders that have developed nursing competencies for telehealth, for the practicing nurse, for nursing education, based on kind of some overarching a framework for the competencies. So we're moving in the right direction. We have to have standards and competencies for both physician practice, but most importantly, I think for nursing, because nurses are the ones that are building programs. They're the ones that are developing the protocols. They're the ones that are evaluating. They're often the person that sits at the C-suite that makes the decision for an institution. So I applaud them, and we need to bring nursing to the table.
Yeah, I would agree with you that telehealth actually encourages interdisciplinary clinical work, and we need to see more nurses at the table when we start to create these standards, the protocols, the clinically driven care delivery models, that's important. And if we don't see nurses in that table, then we're gonna miss that. So I'm in agreement. That was good insight, Dr. Gustin, thank you.
Aren't we seeing nurses doing more in the hospitals now? Not to take away from the doctors, but it seems like doctors have their place, but nurses, it's going to become even more important, especially with utilizing telehealth in the hospital and providing that care. So I agree. It's going to be very important to include the nurses in the standards and the competencies.
You're absolutely right. And if we prepare nurses at the undergraduate level for telehealth, when they are in a facility that's not utilizing it, they'll be able to encourage their facilities to utilize the technology. Simple things like tablets at the bedside that during this COVID pandemic, the tablet in the patient's room and a tablet outside of the room has prevented teams of people needing to go in to assess the patient, thereby decreasing PPE and exposure to the team. And that's telehealth.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. Yep. And that's happening every day.
We're talking to Dr. Tina Gustin from Old Dominion University and talking about her course on telehealth. Dr. Gustin, can you tell us what can students expect? I know this is a difficult year. I have a college student going back. What can students expect to learn at ODU this year? How are you guys going to be formulating your plan? Is it going to be in person, lecture halls, virtual? What's ODU's strategy, returning students?
The strategy is twofold. The undergraduate students are having a combination of virtual and in-person. Their class sizes are divided. So I'm speaking to nursing and what we're doing in nursing. Our graduate and our doctorate level students are all going to be virtual. Our students with regards to telehealth will all be going through the telehealth certification program. We're also working, which is very exciting, with a grant funding. We are providing our nurse practitioner students for integrated healthcare, and we're going to be working with the NPs as well as behavioral health providers, clinical counseling, social work, and we're taking our students into underserved community areas in our state, some of which are homeless shelters, the migrant workers on the eastern shore of Virginia, out west in some of our rural areas. So our student integrated teams are going to be providing care, and they're going to be remotely coming back virtually through telehealth to our faculty providers that are going to mentor and direct their care. So that's some of our new work this year that we're really excited about.
Lots of planning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You all had to do a lot to prepare for that, those different programs and new curriculums.
We are, and another thing that we're starting this year as well, and we have really focused up to this point on our master's and doctorate level nursing students. And to your point, Joe, about the bedside nurse and how telehealth has really moved into the hospital setting where most of the undergraduates are, we're going to be moving into the undergraduate curriculum as well to prepare them for telehealth.
A lot of students looking at getting into healthcare, and what would a freshman expect? How would they plan to, you know, start their education at ODU? And how does ODU separate them as a teaching university for these up-and-coming high school students learning healthcare and wanting to start a career in healthcare? Would they be coming on campus directly? I'm hearing a lot of the freshman class is low this year. There's not a lot of kids coming, applying to colleges. Are you seeing that at ODU?
I cannot speak to the numbers of the undergraduate students. We are bringing, actually this weekend, we're beginning to bring our students on campus. They have done what all the other universities have done. They've been very mindful. Our state in general has been really very mindful with regards to masks and social distancing. They've been busy this summer cleaning and preparing dorms so that the students are at a distance. We have a medical science department at ODU, so we're doing our own testing. We're doing our own PCR testing of students. We're having to log in every day, students and faculty, answering questions about our symptoms and our health and our exposure and whether to isolate or whether to test. Our athletics they announced, I think it was a week ago, that we won't have any fall sports. It's different. And my children have all graduated from college, so I don't have a college student now, but I have friends like you that are sending their children off, and what they're sharing with me is these kids had, freshmen in general, had such a different final semester of high school. I mean, they quit going to school. They didn't go to their prom. They didn't graduate. You know, my daughter graduated from graduate school in May, and we did a drive-by for her. No walk, no graduation. These incoming freshmen, interestingly, they don't know any different.
Yeah.
And they're just so happy to have something that they haven't had since February.
Good point.
Yeah, I think kids are excited to get back to school and a normal way of learning. I agree. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine what it would have been like if this happened in the 80s when I was in school.
They're adapting.
They're adapting. And I read something yesterday that said this may be, so I'm talking K-12 now, that this may be our hardiest group of children yet, that, to your point, Michelle, have had to adapt
in so many different ways. There have been several things that they've had to adapt to, whether it's school safety drills, to virtual learning, to some of these kids that are graduating, right? We're 9/11 babies, so we changed the way we do school and protecting kids in school, and how we changed curriculum. Curriculum changed in the midst of them. So yeah, they've had a lot of changes for sure. Thanks for being here, Dr. Gustin.
It's always great having you, Dr. Gustin. I appreciate your time to speak with us again tonight.
You're welcome.
We only provide our listeners with helpful information on this show, and I appreciate your time to join us tonight and offer insight to explain how Old Dominion University is offering telehealth courses as part of your curriculum for training students to become the best doctors and nurses and making them feel comfortable when it's time to administer virtual care professionally in the future. Thank you for that. Many thanks to our show's sponsor, Michelle Hager, and Blue Cirrus Consulting. That's blue-cirrus.com. Please visit our website for all your telehealth information. And also thank you, Blue Cirrus, for their support in making this radio show happen. Thanks to all our listeners locally and nationally. Everyone, have a great rest of your week. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Dr. Gustin.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Dr. Gustin.
Oh, thank you, Joe and Michelle. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Okay, this is WATD 95.9 FM, Friends with Benefits.